You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News coming to you on Saturday, May 2. It's a beautiful day in Northern California. And today I'm talking about hormone replacement in women who have hypogonadism. Before we begin, let me just make a few general statements about estrogens and progestins in women. They're obviously very important hormones. Deficiencies lead to a number of things, including diminished libido, vaginal dryness, lack of menses, infertility, memory loss, hot flashes and flushes, abnormalities in cholesterol, with the cholesterol tending to be less favorable and more likely to lead to coronary heart disease and other peripheral vascular diseases, and also osteoporosis. In fact, it's known that about 10% of the bone density is lost in the first 5 to 7 years after menopause or after the development of hypogonadism. That's pretty remarkable. And of course, decreases in bone mineral density leading to osteoporosis can lead to compressions, fractures in the spine with the Dowager's hump, fractures in the hip, which have an associated morbidity and mortality, and fractures in the feet. Now, I think there are a lot of reasons to consider hormone replacement if you have hypogonadism. I tend to be a proponent of hormone replacement. I'm not paid by any pharmaceutical companies. I don't sit on the advisory boards of any companies that promote female hormone replacement. Because of my experience over the past more than a quarter of a century taking care of women with hypogonadism, and not only seeing the benefits, but also some of the disadvantages of hormone replacement, I'm definitely more in favor of treatment than not. There are, however, situations where you might not want to take hormone replacement, and those include if you or a first-degree relative, such as a sister or a mother, have a history of breast cancer. You want to be careful and certainly consider annual mammograms if you choose to be treated with estrogens and progestins. Women who have a history of a blood clotting disorder or genetic risk of such might want to be careful and consider topical estrogens rather than oral estrogens if they do proceed with treatment. And then women who have hypertriglyceridemia should be very careful because estrogens can worsen hypertriglyceridemia and lead to complications such as pancreatitis and skin rashes. I also believe that women who have pre-existing coronary artery disease are probably more likely to have coronary thrombosis and myocardial infarctions, so that if you have coronary disease or other peripheral vascular disease, you might want to be careful and consider whether or not to use estrogens. And if you do, that might be a situation where you would use topical estrogens to decrease your risk of blood clotting over an atheromatous plaque that can lead to a problem. So I advise you to give some thought to, certainly if you have hypogonadism, to why you might want to be treated. Some women want to be younger and healthy and continue an active lifestyle, active sexuality, prevent bone density losses, and prevent that change in cholesterol that increases the risk of coronary artery disease. Others simply want to have normal hormones to feel well and to not have hot flashes and flushes, for example. It really comes down to being an individual decision or treatment choice. And though I am in favor of estrogen and progestin supplementation, I allow my patients to make their own decisions about treatment. One more thing to cover before I do talk about the different ways of proceeding with treatment is, let's address the issue of breast carcinoma. It's known that about 1 in 11 women will develop breast cancer in this country. A small proportion of women obviously will die from that disease. It's estimated that the risk of breast cancer while taking estrogen supplementation in menopause is increased by 1.4-fold, meaning essentially that that risk of breast cancer may go from 11% to 15%. It's still a very slight increased risk, and some believe that that increased likelihood may be because women who are treated with estrogens undergo mammograms more regularly and the detection rate is increased, rather than simply estrogen promoting the formation or the development of new breast cancers. I don't think we'll ever really truly have an answer to which came first, the chicken or the egg. But this is why women who have a family history of breast cancer in a first-degree relative, such as a mother or a sister or a brother, because there is a problem sometimes with breast cancer in men who have the genetic history there, should consider whether or not they want to take estrogens, and if so, to proceed with careful screening. Interestingly, probably about 20 years ago now, I read a paper that looked at the risk-benefit ratios of estrogens, and they evaluated the potential increased mortality in women treated with estrogens as a result of breast cancer against the potential decreased mortality due to cardiovascular disease in women who take estrogens, because estrogens lead to a more favorable cardiovascular risk profile. And I don't remember the exact specifics of this study, but as I recall, they concluded that for every person who died of breast cancer, you saved about 10 lives due to cardiovascular disease. So even considering breast cancer, the risk-benefit ratio probably is still in favor of taking estrogens to decrease cardiovascular risk. Why is this all a problem? Well, you know, 100 years ago, women didn't live to menopausal age. And now that we have antibiotics and other medical therapies, women are living to 75 to 80 years on average and spending about a third of their lifetime postmenopausal. And those who have hypothalamic or pituitary disorders obviously could potentially spend a half or nearly all of their lives without estrogen. And I'm not sure that our bodies were designed to live as long as we do, or that women truly were meant to be without estrogen. So teleologically, I'm a fan of hormone replacement. When it comes to treatment, there are obviously several options. Women can take medication to deal with the hot flashes and flushes and make other lifestyle changes. Estriven is one of the most prominent drugs that help with the hot flashes. And then one considers estrogens and progestins. And of course, there are lots of different ways to sort of replace these hormones and different advantages and disadvantages of some of the delivery systems. In general, women who have a uterus should receive estrogens and progestins. And the reason being is that the estrogens alone would stimulate the endometrial lining to grow, and if that goes unchecked, there can be the development of endometrial cancer. So taking a progestin also prevents that development of the lining, or if you do so cyclically, you can have a menstrual period and slough off that endometrial lining so that it does not build up and lead to endometrial carcinoma. Women who have had a hysterectomy can take estrogens alone. There's really, truly no reason for them to take a progestin as well. Of course, with any of the regimens, the benefits follow treatment. The goals are usually to alleviate symptoms, improve physiology, and also to prevent complications such as osteoporosis and cardiovascular disease. Now, let's talk about some of the specifics. Young women can often take oral contraceptive pills. Most of the pills today have a low-dose estrogen relative to the pills of 20 years ago and are safe and effective ways of producing sufficient amounts of estrogen and progestin for the woman's body so that she can remain healthy. So generally in women of reproductive age, I don't have a problem using one of the traditional oral contraceptive pill regimens. In middle-aged and older women, I tend to provide an estrogen and a progestin so that I can use lower doses of these medications. And that's generally because medical science for some reason has assumed that the older you are, the lower your hormone level should be. I'm not sure that's entirely true, but I will tell you that I have seen some older women with high estrogen levels, and it can lead to problems such as blood clots and breast tenderness and abnormal uterine bleeding that are not appropriate and can be very discomforting. So we tend to use lower doses of estrogen as women age. Perhaps the most common form of oral estrogen that I employ is estradiol, 1 milligram in older women, sometimes a half a milligram, 2 milligram in younger women. Those who have a uterus also receive Prometrium, which is my favorite of all the progestins. It's a micronized form of progesterone and tends to lead to less side effects than, say, using one of the other forms of progestins. I use 200 milligrams daily for the first 10 days of every month. Usually women will have a menstrual period about 7 to 10 days after discontinuing that medication. And those women who do not want to have menstrual periods, I use 100 milligrams daily. This regimen might result in some abnormal uterine bleeding for the first 6 months or so, but ultimately it suppresses menstrual flow. I usually check estrogen levels about 6 weeks after starting treatment. I like to see the levels greater than 50 and less than about 250. I think those are a fairly safe range. Levels greater than 50 generally protect bones from bone loss. And levels over 250 might be associated with a higher risk of breast tenderness and blood clots, and that's why I try to keep the level under that amount of estrogen in the bloodstream. I am also a proponent of using estrogen patches, with the Climera patch and the Vivel dot patch systems to be the most common ones that I would employ in my practice. I tend to prefer the patches in women who have a history of hypertriglyceridemia or blood clots or some other form of liver disease. I also think that, and I would add that some of my patients feel better using the patch rather than taking the medication orally. This might have something to do with absorption and stable blood levels, but I'm not really entirely sure. I'm definitely opposed to the use of estrogen pellets in women. In my experience, the pellets lead to very high and dangerous levels of estrogens. I've seen several women who've used the pellets, and most of them have estradiol levels over 2,000. Remember, the goal is 50 to 250, and I just don't think it's safe to have that amount of estrogen in the bloodstream. In regards to androgen replacement, women who have hypogonadism often have adrenal insufficiency as well. The ovaries and the adrenals each produce about 45% of the testosterone in women, and the remaining 10% is made up by the peripheral conversion of estrogens to androgens. So those women who are hypopituitary and missing both adrenal and ovarian function usually have very low testosterone levels. In those women, I'm not opposed to the use of a low dose of testosterone or even the use of DHEA to try to increase androgen levels to treat diminished libido. I recommend checking the testosterone level in 6 weeks just to ensure that it's not elevated, because such could lead to abnormal menses, excessive hair growth, acne, oily skin, and abnormal cholesterol profile. So that's pretty much my approach. There are a lot of estrogens on the market, and I think that you'll find as many approaches as you will physicians who treat hypogonadism or menopause, and I urge you to work with your physicians to derive a treatment regimen that would best suit you. And lastly, remember that we can achieve normal gonadal function by treating the underlying disease in many patients. For example, if a patient has a prolactinoma or other cause of hyperprolactinemia, restoring the prolactin to normal will restore pituitary gonadal function to normal, lead to resumption of menses, appropriate hormone levels, etc. Furthermore, if a patient has a pituitary adenoma that's compromising pituitary function, sometimes removal of that tumor leads to improvement in pituitary function and restoration of normal gonadal function. So keep in mind that treatment of the underlying disease is probably first and foremost in the mind of the physician, and in those patients who have persistent hypogonadism or where we know it's going to persist after treatment of the disease process, that's when hormone replacement comes into play. Well, a 15-minute podcast, that's a very brief introduction to this topic. And I'll try to put some things on the website where you can learn more about hormone replacement so that you can be better informed, make educated choices about your health care, and also teach your doctors and your friends and family members. So this is, again, Lewis Blevins from Pituitary World News coming to you from the Sea Ranch, California. Have a good day.